This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last night, disaster relief expert Fred Cuny returned to the United States from a month in Chechnya, where the war rages on. Since December, Russia has used air power and ground troops to prevent the largely Muslim republic from seceding. Much of the capital city, Grozny, is in ruins. Cuny's mission was to evaluate humanitarian needs in Chechnya, as well as to assess where the war is heading and what can be done to end the fighting. He went on behalf of the Open Society Institute, which is funded by the Soros Foundation. Cuny has done disaster relief work since the 1969 Biafran War. Recently, he directed the rebuilding of water and gas lines in Sarajevo, which he discussed with us on his previous visit to Fresh Air. Cuny is the founding president of the Intertect Relief and Reconstruction Corporation in Texas. Earlier today, I asked him how much fighting there is in Chechnya now.
Quite a bit. The Chechens still hold a large portion of the city exclusively. They control the areas that are south of the river. They have a large segment of about a quarter of the city that they control entirely. But they can move any place in the city they want. They have routes in and out of the city from the south. They have ways to reach the northern parts of the city where there's a large Russian military presence. And they virtually control the city, despite the fact that the Russians have about 30,000 troops there.
Before we get into some of the specifics, maybe you could give us just a broad overview of what you found.
Well, certainly from an immediate point of view, the biggest single problem is the number of civilians who are still trapped in the southern, southeastern parts of the city. The Chechens are ironically fighting a war in the city to protect a Russian population from Russian bombing. The people who are left are essentially Russian ethnic origin or other Slavic groups. They are elderly. I'd say probably 90% or 70 years or older. They are people who were retired pensioners, people who lived in what they call the internats or the welfare homes for the elderly, who couldn't escape. All the Chechens that were there have long gone, and the way the battle unfolded, there was a corridor that was left to the south of the city for people to evacuate, and the Chechens took all their people and left. And so you have now a small number of fighters that are still in the area that are fighting the Russians and pinning them down and making them pay a penalty for being there. But the civilians that are left in that area are all Russians or Slavs who are increasingly becoming vulnerable to the situation. There's no water, there's no gas or heat, no light. Food supplies are minimal, and things are beginning to deteriorate very rapidly for these people. They need to be evacuated.
Did you interview any of the ethnic Russians who are trapped in Grozny, and what kinds of stories did they tell you about how the military, the Russian military, has been treating the remaining civilians?
Yes, I interviewed about 200 people that were living in the various shelters. They live in sort of three different types of accommodations. The people who were living in large apartment complexes, the buildings have been destroyed, but the basements are intact. And you have large numbers of people living in the basements. You also have people living in the old civil defense bomb shelters that were built during the Cold War era. And in some ways, they're the ones who are the best off because the bomb shelters are quite deep and you get some insulation from the earth that's above them. But there's no way to heat them because they're not very well ventilated. So at night, they have to seal everything up and the temperatures are still very cold, but they're not freezing. The people who are living in the bombed-out buildings are much closer to the surface, and it's harder to keep the buildings warm. There are a lot of leaks, and often the temperatures are below freezing in those. And you have a third group that are living in bombed-out factories. And the reason they've chosen the factories is they can go into the buildings and get between the machinery, and the machinery provides some protection from fragmentation when the bombs go off. Of all the groups, they're probably the worst off. And those are the areas, actually, where we have a number of children in the area. Those kind of facilities have more children than the others. But again, I want to stress that most of the people there are old and elderly, former pensioners or pensioners and former veterans that are caught there and not able to leave. The situation is such that they don't really come into contact with the Russian military directly. The Chechens hold a line of confrontation and and prevent the Russian army from coming into the area. So what happens is the Russians basically bomb the city. They use aircraft and heavy artillery. And the way the war has been unfolding is the Chechens have had small teams that have been able to control the intersections and the roads and fire from buildings, and so the Russians have responded by destroying the buildings. So what's happening is, you know, block by block, the city's being reduced to rubble.
It must be very eerie in the city now, since a lot of it is destroyed. There's still a lot of fighting going on, and most of the people are living in subterranean places.
It is very, very eerie. I've been on both sides of the lines. We managed to get into the northern part with some people who were being asked to return to the city by the Russians. The Russian government has been telling people that the city is now secure and that people can go back, and they've organized buses to bring them back. So I actually hopped on one of these buses and went with the people back to the city. And what we found, of course, is that the minute we got there, people saw the extent of the damages, learned there was no food, no water, and they got back on the bus and left. So very few of the people who came down are staying. Nobody lives above ground, even on the government-occupied areas, the areas that the Russians have a large military presence. They have virtually no control over those sections of the city. The Chechen fighters can pop up from the sewers anytime and shoot. There's still shelling that goes on back from in retaliation across the lines. The Russian soldiers are extremely scared. They get into the areas that they're holding, build small foxholes and protective settlements, and then hunker down and hope that nobody shoots them.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Fred Cuny. He's the founder of Intertact, which is an emergency management consulting firm, and he just returned from Chechnya, where he spent about a month assessing the humanitarian situation there for the group Open Society. Now, I believe that you toured Grozny with Chechen forces and with Russian forces. Is that right?
That's correct. The first time I went in, I met with some Chechen leaders. They reluctantly agreed to take me in with them. We slipped through the Russian lines at night. In the process, we could see Russian tanks on either side of us, and but managed to go right through the middle of the lines and got to their headquarters inside Grozny, and then I spent time with them going through the city, and they were showing us that, in fact, they could, in fact, get anywhere they wanted to go and that they could move without too much difficulty.
How do they do it, could you say?
Well, they've got all sorts of ways of moving. A large number of their movements are through the tunnels that are under the city. Crossing the river is the most dangerous thing because you're exposed during that time, so that's done largely at night. They slip across, you know, one at a time, very stealthily. There are some other ways that they have, which I don't want to mention, but they have some routes in. Once on the Russian side, they just simply move from abandoned building to abandoned building, and often going through basements or through these tunnels that connected the buildings. They go through buildings that appear to have collapsed, and they've created their own little entrances and exits, and they can move right across the city very quickly without too much difficulty.
Did both sides try to convince you of their justness in the war?
Of course. But
what are some of the things they each told you justifying their side?
Well, the Chechens, to them, it's just a straight issue of independence. They feel that they were never a part of Russia, that the Federation is an artificial concoction that came out of the collapse of the Soviet Union. They argue that they were an occupied territory that's been in constant revolt ever since they joined or were captured back in the 1860s, and that they have a legitimate right to be independent. And that's it. It's a strictly black and white issue on their side. On the Russian side, it's you know, there are many different fears that the Russians have. One is that this could be the beginning of a breakdown of Russia, that they have to deal with the issue of minorities in Russia, and that they can't simply allow one republic to go, because then, you know, any group could get together, create sort of a border and say, you know, it's theirs and they want out. And that this would leave Russia strapped of resources and rapidly shrinking territory, and one that would be largely at war with itself. So those are the kind of concerns that the Russians expressed to us on their side. And there's validity, of course, in both positions. The question is, you know, how do you resolve these issues? And certainly the answer is not by trying to destroy the city and kill all these people.
My guest is disaster relief and reconstruction expert Fred Cuny. He's just returned from a month in Chechnya. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with disaster relief expert Fred Cuny, who's just returned from Chechnya. This doesn't seem to be a very popular war in Russia. I've read about desertions in the Russian army and mothers trying to track down their sons and get them out of the war. Was there a lot of unhappiness among the Russian soldiers that you spoke with?
Oh, the Russian soldiers are really in a bind on this. The average soldier does not want to be there. They realize that they're being poorly led. They're not well supplied. There are food shortages or water shortages on the part of the Russian military. It's clear that their tactics have not worked. They blame the senior commanders for getting them into this. But on the ground, there have been very little in the way of desertions. But what you have is this incredible phenomena. I haven't seen anything like this anywhere else, where the families, the mothers, have begun putting pressure on the military to let their sons go. And mothers get on train and go down to the military headquarters, get a pass, and then go over and grab the sons and pull them out of the army. And the army lets them go. There's a large rate of desertion of people who are being sent to Grozny. And soldiers get off trains, or they desert at their bases before they get sent to the battle site. And the Russian army has responded by setting up an office in Moscow where the deserters can go and be reassigned other units without prejudice. So you have, obviously within the army and the military structure in general, a real reluctance to get involved in this war. Some of it is because they think it's the wrong war. Others, they're not prepared to fight this war. Others, because they're afraid of what it's going to do to the military. There are many different agendas that the military itself has for not being involved in this. But on the ground, many of the senior commanders are opposed to the war, but they're prosecuting it very vigorously because they're following orders. So it's a really mixed bag. It's hard to find a motivation that's uniform throughout the military on this.
What are you going to recommend the priority should be for human rights?
Well, we think that the major thing that needs to be done is to help evacuate the people. We think that the people who are remaining there are Russian. They all want to leave. Most have places they could go until the situation stabilizes. And we think it's extremely important that pressures be put on Russian government to recognize that the people that they're likely to kill are going to be these very innocent old people who they're going to die one way or the other. Either they're going to die in the collapse of buildings as the Russians continue to bomb those areas, or they're going to die from, lack of food and exposure because they can't move and go anyplace else, and supplies are running out, and their ability to withstand these conditions over long periods of time just isn't there.
What would it take to get them out?
Well, we think an evacuation could be organized by the Russian authorities. There's a ministry for special emergency situations that has lots of capabilities, and they've got trucks and buses and so forth, and they could certainly handle the evacuation without too much difficulty. It's just a matter of getting a ceasefire to make that happen. And what we're hoping is that the international community will step in and encourage the government of Russia to create this ceasefire and to get the people out of there.
Will there be other recommendations?
Well, we have some that are specific to the work of the organizations that are there. For example, we're working with a surgical group there to provide additional surgical support in some of the frontline medical centers, along with other groups such as the International Committee of the Red Cross and Médecins Sans Frontières. That's a French group. We've also made recommendations on how to improve the shelter situation in Ingushetia. We want to help improve the registration system in conjunction with work being done by the International Organization for Migration. There are a number of specific activities that we would like to support, with the small amount of money that we have available. But these are decisions that have not been made yet. We're simply making these recommendations to the Open Society Institute and to see what it wants to fund.
Is there any end in sight to the fighting?
I don't see it right away. It's going to be a long time before they really have any effective control over the city. The Chechens don't have a large force in the city. It's probably no more than about 1,500 hardcore fighters. And so it's very easy for them to set up small hit teams that move around the town. And the way the Russians respond to the shooting is to level the buildings. And they can continue to level buildings all day long, but the Chechens can still move through the rubble fairly easily. They don't have to resupply a large number of people. If they lose a dozen men a day, it's easy to infiltrate those guys through the lines and rebuild their forces on the inside of the city and just to keep on hitting the Russians. One of the Russian general officers who's in the commandant's office in Grozny, and I had a discussion. I said, what's next? Where are you going to go after you get out of Grozny? He said, we're never going to get out of Grozny.
Well, it sounds like if the war does end, or when the war does end, that the city will have to be nearly totally rebuilt.
Absolutely. They're going to have to start over from scratch. So many of the tactics that the Russians are using are counterproductive. For example, they know the Chechens move through these tunnels and these conduits. So what they have to do to stop and reduce their mobility is to blow them up. But if you blow up the conduits, you can't run the water system. Without the water system, nobody's going to come back to the city. So they're really caught in the old Vietnam syndrome. You have to destroy the city in order to save it. The general officers on the ground know that this is a problem, and they're sitting there shaking their heads. How do we bring this thing to an end without creating such a situation that they can never reoccupy the city?
And of course, it's to the Russian advantage for the Chechens to come back to Grozny.
But as long as the Russians are there, they won't come back. The only way they'll come back is as fighters to attack the Russians.
My guest is Fred Cuny, and he's the founder and president of Intertech Relief and Reconstruction Corporation, which provides emergency management consultation. And he's just returned from Chechnya, where he was analyzing the humanitarian situation for a group called the Open Society Institute. Fred Cuny, the last time we spoke, about a year and a half ago, you were working on restoring gas and water to Sarajevo. What's the status of the gas and water lines that you installed there?
The gas project has gone now into another phase. It's being handled by the International Rescue Committee and supported by the U.S. AID, Agency for International Development. And I'd say that the gas project is probably one of the most successful projects in Sarajevo. We've installed now almost 80,000 meters of gas mains and easily another 100,000 meters of pipes to connect people to the houses. And virtually no one in Sarajevo is going to die of exposure or lack of heat as long as the gas keeps coming. The water system is complete. The water is coming into the city. We've had a real hard time with the local authorities on some of the keeping the plants going, mainly because there's a dispute about what kind of standards the water system should meet and the difficulty of actually proving those under combat conditions. But the water is going into the city, and it's providing about 60% of all the water that's going into the town now.
Did your work in Sarajevo help you in evaluating what's happening in Chechnya?
Yes, it did. It gave a really solid frame of reference to the needs of urban populations. And one of the most interesting things for me in terms of comparing Sarajevo to Grozny was the difference that aerial bombing made of the city compared to Sarajevo. In Sarajevo, we established the no-fly zone, which is enforced by NATO, which has kept the Serbian bombers and fighter planes with bombs from attacking the city. And what that has meant is that we could do the water project because only the heavy bombs break up the water mains that run underneath the ground. In Grozny, where you had the penetration bombs and attempts to blow up buildings with big, heavy 500-kilogram bombs and so on, those destroyed the water system, destroyed the gas system. There was no way that you could get water in, so you have to go on using tankers to deliver water on the surface. And, of course, nobody wants to be outside and drive a tanker through town with all the fighting going on. So the real difference has been if you can keep the airplanes out of the bombing equation, you have a chance of delivering water and keeping the city municipal systems relatively intact.
You have a private consulting and relief and reconstruction company. You've worked with the UN, you've worked with the Red Cross, you've worked with the Soros Foundation, which is a private foundation. Do you think that the role of governments and private foundations and businesses is shifting in relationship to the civil wars that we're seeing?
Well, I think right now there's a lot of rethinking about the whole international system. Clearly, the system is not working very well. It's really a collection of ad hoc organizations that are trying to accomplish a number of goals, each with their own agendas. And there have been real difficulties in places like Bosnia, where the issue of neutrality has become an obstacle rather than a facilitating environment. The role of peacekeeping troops, the fact that we have peacekeepers who are sent to an area with no mandate to protect people, but only to protect relief operations, is ludicrous. And I think the whole issue of whether we get into peace enforcement or peacemaking versus peacekeeping is a question that needs to really be looked at very, very heavily.
Fred Cooney is the founding president of the Intertect Relief and Reconstruction Corporation in Texas, which consults with voluntary and governmental agencies as well as the UN. He returned from his trip to Chechnya last night. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.